It's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another star system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth?
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, one centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and good evening. You're listening to UBC Sharing Science Radio, broadcasting live from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Sharing Science Radio is here to bring you a weekly dose of science news, discussion, interviews, and local events. I'm your host, Tanya, and with me today are Sam, Rohit, and Alan. On tonight's show, we're going to learn about Bug Fight Club, the Leap Second, and we're going to hear about a meta-study covering parenting.
So, I'm actually presenting a story from Nathan. Thanks, Nathan, for doing all the hard work. Do you know someone who was born on February 29th? Adults born on this day sometimes claim they are only 5 or 10 years old, and that they will likely die around age 20 or 25. Feb 29th is, of course, the day that only comes around once every 4 years, every leap year. It's an extra day spliced into the calendar every so often to account for the fact that a year isn't really a year. That is, it takes the Earth a little bit longer than 365 days to get around the sun. The error from the 365 days miscalculation is made up by adding an extra day every 4 years. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. No one on Earth can count. Yesterday, we actually had a leap second. Tuesday, June 30th, 2015, was actually an extra second longer than any other day. And the reason we have leap seconds is exactly the same reason as for leap years. A single day, the time it takes for the Earth to rotate once, is not exactly 24 hours. The weird thing about the leap second is that it isn't really predictable. Gravitational oddities between the Earth and the Moon are partly to blame for this anomaly. But scientists don't quite understand this error in our timekeeping. That's because the way the Earth spins keeps changing so that the corrective seconds we need to apply are always a little bit different. These errors are, however, very important. All of our navigation and GPS systems today rely on extremely precise timekeeping. Signals from navigation instruments are beamed up to satellites and then around the world, and it's the exact time of arrival for that beam that tells everyone where they are. If the clocks go even a little out of whack, the whole system wouldn't work. To keep accurate track of the leap seconds that are accruing as the Earth spins, vast arrays of radio telescopes are working together around the world. The policy implementing the leap second was adopted in 1972, and at that time, we need to displace leap seconds into the calendar about once a year. Tuesday's leap second, however, was the last since 2013 and only one of four in the last couple of decades. It's something to think about when you check your watch this morning.
Researchers have discovered a new way to force bacteria to create molecules that could be a source of antibiotics and anti-cancer drugs, and they call it Bug Fight Club. Bacteria, fungi, and plants can often whip out special molecules called secondary metabolites for specialized purposes apart from growth and reproduction, and this is often to defend themselves from attack. Many of these secondary metabolites are useful antibiotics or anti-cancer drugs, but plants and bacteria don't produce these when they don't have to. So in order to discover new potentially useful secondary metabolites from bacteria, we need a way to force them to excrete these. Welcome to Bug Fight Club. Nocardiopsis, a bacterium that grows in the soil, was matched against four other types of bacteria, forcing the two species to grow together on a culture. Afterwards, the researchers analyzed the molecules that were secreted by a method called ion mobility mass spectrometry and found that Nocardiopsis had whipped out some crazy new molecular moves in order to compete with the other species. After analyzing all the secondary metabolites, they found one that resembles an antibiotic already on the market and could be used as a future drug. Now, this is great news because there is a desperate need for new antibiotics, but there's no word yet on the soap-making ability of these microorganisms.
In other news, UBC has just welcomed a superstar researcher to the faculty. Dr. Jenny Hoffman just left her tenured position at Harvard to join UBC's Physics Department and the Quantum Matter Institute as one of Canada's prestigious Canada Excellence Research Chairs. The Canada Excellence Research Chair Program was launched in 2008 by the feds in an attempt to attract the world's best researchers to Canadian universities. This is both a sort of reverse brain drain as well as a play to put Canada on the map scientifically. The program awards $10 million over 7 years to each chair. As UBC was searching for a candidate for the chair, Dr. Hoffman was thinking about making a move from Harvard. She wrote down a list of 10 universities she would consider moving to, which included prestigious institutions such as Stanford, Berkeley, and Cornell. UBC was the only Canadian institution on the list. Beating out such a distinguished group of universities was not easy. The CERC funding of $10 million certainly helped, as did UBC's promise to build Dr. Hoffman a new building to house a state-of-the-art laboratory for her research. The new building will be a home for UBC's already active Quantum Matter Institute and will be an extension to the Ample building. Construction started earlier this year. But even all that wasn't enough for Dr. Hoffman. What she really wanted was a highly collaborative environment where she could bring her research to the next level with the help of an amazing group of colleagues, and UBC had exactly that. She has already collaborated with some UBC researchers, last year publishing a paper in the journal Science on high-temperature superconductors with Dr. Andrea Damascelli of UBC's Physics Department. Now that she is at UBC, she will be entering a new stage in her research where she will focus on creating and characterizing new materials with specific properties. All of the scientists involved hope to see this new era of research result in an expanded understanding of quantum mechanics and matter at the nanoscale. It is more broadly hoped that this understanding will bring us room-temperature superconductors, materials which could revolutionize energy technologies, and tiny devices which could change everything from computing to medical equipment. I'm definitely not holding my breath in anticipation of room-temperature superconductors, but I will be pretty stoked if one day I can say it was discovered at my alma mater.
On the topic of that meta-study, in the news recently is the monumental decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to legalize same-sex marriage in all states, and coincidentally, a paper set to be published this September in the Journal of Social Science Research reached the conclusion that children who grow up in the same-sex parenting household are what the authors deemed no different than children from any other type of parenting situation. A lot of people are probably thinking to themselves, you needed scientists to figure that out? But from a scientific point of view, this is not a trivial finding. Prejudice towards non-traditional families is still present in society, and this study has major implications on how the judicial system works. As recently as 2013, disagreement between sociologists on outcomes for children of same-sex marriages was used as an argument for preventing the legalization of same-sex marriage. The study I'll discuss today is also very interesting from a scientific perspective, as it is an example of what is called a meta-study, where authors of the study study past studies. And now that is a tongue twister. The goal of this study was to determine whether there is a consensus in the scientific community on whether children who are reared by same-sex parents are any different from those that are in any other type of parenting situation.
All right, thanks for those awesome stories, guys. We'll be right back after these messages.
Scandal is coming to Vancouver. Now Theatre, in collaboration with Chimera Theatre Collective, present the comedy event of the summer. Guaranteed to shock, scintillate, and make you hot and bothered, complete with gossip, intertwining relationships, ringing smartphones, and sexy yoga moves. The School for Scandal brings Richard Sheridan's comedy of manners for unmannerly people into the 21st century. So come out to CBC Studios from June 28th to July 5th for a scandalously good time. For showtimes and ticket information, find us at Facebook under School for Scandal 2015 or contact us at schoolforscandal15@gmail.com.
Welcome back to UBC's Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. Let's get started on the discussion. Alan, I wanted to ask you, why do we need new antibiotics so desperately?
Well, that's a great question. This has been something that's been in the news quite a bit, but actually we are running out of antibiotics faster than we're replacing them. Most of the antibiotics we use right now are based on some natural chemical that are excreted by bacteria or plants or fungi to kill other bacteria But we're really running out of these. And the reason why is because we're using antibiotics, but as we use them, bacteria evolve defenses to get around them. And that's basically it.
Yeah, so, like, that's a great point, Alan. It's also why our doctors, when they give us antibiotics, they prescribe us to finish the entire bottle. It's because if we don't, then we run a risk of giving these bacteria or whatever is causing our illness a chance to grow resistant to the same antibiotics we were prescribed.
That's exactly right, Rohit. Yeah, if you basically what happens is this is evolution in action, and so if you take your antibiotics but you don't finish them all, there might be some bacteria that survive, and the bacteria that survive are the ones that might have genes or something that makes them a little bit stronger to the antibiotics, and those ones that survive will live and have offspring, and those offspring will now be more resistant to the antibiotics.
Just to jump in here, Alan, I think it's important to note that when we say that our population is running out of antibiotics, it's not our stocks of what we already have right now. It's the new ones that we're worried about. Because it's when the bacteria are developing the resistance, it's not that we need more and more and more, or we're doubling the dose of an already used antibiotic. It's that we need new ones, and we need a novel way to destroy these bacteria.
That's a good point.
Penicillin was one of the first antibiotics discovered. Don't we still use that?
Yeah, we do. I think that's a great point.
We do use penicillin, but we actually use its derivatives more often. Things like amoxicillin. Now, these are drugs that are very similar to penicillin, very similar to the penicillin molecule, but they're tweaked a little bit. And every tweak we give them, the bacteria now have to develop resistance to that tweak. But the thing is, we can only tweak them so much, and so we really need sort of a novel, exactly. Thank you, Tanya. A novel, completely new sort of molecules, and that's what the people in this bug fight club, that's what they're searching for.
Antibiotic resistance in bacteria develops because of random mutations to the bacteria, and it's those random mutations that allow the bacteria to survive, and all of its
Progeny,
thank you. All the progeny live, and that overtakes your entire population of whatever bacteria that is. But it's important to note, and I think this is the case for penicillin, is that the bacteria, over the course of time, if they were to develop penicillin resistance and we change the weapon that we were trying to kill them with, maybe over time another mutation happens where they're now unable to fight against penicillin again. And I think that may be one reason why we're able to use penicillin still in conjunction with other antibiotics. Because in combination, they're still able to kill the bacteria, but not on their own.
So one day, if we stop using penicillin for 50 years, could we start using it again?
There's a chance of that. But then we also have to consider evolution itself, I would think, that evolution is trying to support traits that help creatures and organisms survive long term. Perhaps 50 years is long enough for penicillin to be effective again. Perhaps it's 100 years, perhaps thousands, if not more. It really depends on where that trait is and how that trait is passed down, I would think.
I just imagine that if we stop using penicillin, then there is no longer that selective force against the bacteria to keep that gene around. Like if we... I just popped into my mind the movie WALL-E, and we see these images and these movies of giant fat humans that no longer need to move. The genes that are associated with healthy living, we no longer need those because now they're just sitting around in chairs all day having their lives taken care of them. They don't need to walk from one place to another. So why would they need the gene that promotes a lot of muscle growth when they're young? Same with the bacteria. If they're not being bombarded with the specific antibiotic penicillin, then that trait is no longer a selective pressure, and bacteria no longer need to have that gene around necessarily.
But if there's no reason to get rid of it, they won't get rid of it necessarily either.
Just random mutation would get rid of it at that point.
Mm. Yeah, it's pretty interesting to see how randomness just affects everything here, from what we do in our daily lives to what kind of organisms are developed through evolution. I don't know about you guys.
That's so interesting. Speaking of randomness, it does seem really random that we just throw in a leap second every once in a while.
Yeah, you're right. But that leap second, I think, is actually pretty important. Don't you?
Well, it wasn't really clear to me why 1 second would make such a big difference.
Same with me, Tanya. I have no idea why a half a second or a full second every couple of years even makes a difference.
So let's go off topic a little bit. You know, let's think about bank transactions. And let's think of high-speed bank transactions. Things that are handling thousands, millions, an absurd amount of money in less than a second. So less than a leap second. These transactions occur so fast and so rapidly that if we're not precise about the time in which they occurred, well, that $1 million you owed me, I might owe you $2 trillion or something smaller, right? We need to be able to keep track to the dot, whatever that dot may be, whatever some very small precision is, what happened when. This occurs in bank transactions. This occurs in even email and other things where two people are trying to message the same person. It affects who gets the message first. As Nathan's story pointed out, it's about navigation and being able to tell where things are in less than a second. Oftentimes, you need to make decisions and have computers do computations in less than a second. So it is important to have that leap second and be able to accurately and precisely keep track of time.
That's really interesting, Rohit. Is it possible that a new personal worst could be set for a racing athlete when an extra second was added into their time?
Well, yes. If you ever see me race, then yes. It's always my personal worst.
Oh, Usain, you're in the studio today? I didn't know that Usain Bolt joined us for the discussion.
Yeah, I don't know. When I'm racing, an extra second doesn't really matter that much. It's so far gone that who cares?
What I don't understand about what you were discussing there, Rohit, was if all the computers are still working on the same time scale, when I'm thinking about it, a second and minutes and hours and time itself is kind of arbitrary, and we only keep track of it for the sake of making our days more convenient. But
All right, Sam, I'm going to stop you there. What about a kilogram? Right? How do we tell that as a standard? Realistically, I don't know, Alan, it seems like you want to pitch it.
Yeah, can I jump in here?
Yeah, go for it.
I think if I can rephrase your question, Sam, maybe you're saying we only care about time intervals, so why does it matter where the zero is? And to answer that, the computer doesn't really know where the zero is, because if I'm talking about the time difference between today at noon and yesterday at noon, does the computer know that there was a second that was missing? Because physically there was, but if there's a leap second and the computer hasn't accounted for it, then the time difference will actually be significantly different. And a second doesn't sound like much, but as Rohit said, in bank transactions and things that require precise timing, it can actually mean a great deal.
It's interesting that although we as humans think of a second as not a big deal, a lot can happen in a second, and less than a second, as a matter of fact. I think, Tana, like, you can give us some instances of things that can happen in less than a second.
A New York minute?
Speed of light, for example.
That's a speed. That's not a thing.
But for light to travel within a second, it can travel a great distance within that 1 second. Can it not?
Light can travel around the Earth 7 times in 1 second.
Yeah. So a lot of things.
To give you an example of definitely lots of things can happen in a second. And right now we are probing chemical reactions and the way that energy moves around in a molecule. And that's down to 1 trillionth of a second, and even less. So that's, you know, we want to get down to those time scales. So if you're considering those things, a second is like forever.
Yeah, and computer operations, I think a really good processor can probably do at least 1 million operations in 1 second, if not more.
Much more. So when we talk about gigahertz in our processors, we're talking about the speed at which these processors can operate and do these operations. So the giga there, as we all know, our standard international prefixes, is a lot, is what it is.
10 to the 6. That's million.
Is it million?
Oh, 10 to the 9.
No, that's mega.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, gig is 10 to the 9.
10 to the 9.
So
yeah.
Billion.
We all don't know our international prefixes.
There we go.
That's the
story of the...
Who let me graduate?
Speaking of physics, so Tanya, tell us more about this quantum physicist coming to UBC.
Well, it's pretty exciting. These Canada research chairs are really a grab for talent. There's not very many. There's only 24 in Canada right now. UBC has one who is in medicine.
Dr. Michael Farr, I think it is?
I think so, yeah. And Dr. Hoffman will be the second one joining us. Yeah. Ideally, she will bring a lot of prestige and accolades to the physics department here at UBC. She'll publish a lot of high-impact research and hopefully discover something really cool so that we can have a couple more Nobel laureates on the UBC list.
Yeah, that would be good. I think it's like science, like anything, is you really require a great group of people and a stimulating environment. So the more talent you can bring in, the better, but also you kind of need a good environment to begin with, and I think UBC already has that. So bringing in Dr. Hoffman to the mix should really create some very interesting science coming out of UBC.
I agree, and that was really the clincher for UBC getting Dr. Hoffman. We threw a bunch of money at it, we built a building, but it was the fact that UBC had such an amazing collaborative group doing this research together, where a theorist would think of something and then an experimentalist would perform the experiment, all together working in unison for the same goal, was what Dr. Hoffman was really after. And it turns out UBC is one of the best universities in the world for that.
Not bad. I think I knew that fact. You know, UBC, we're pretty good.
We also have a really good radio station, I've heard.
This one show on it, it's just phenomenal. It's a bunch of people talking. A question for you, though. You mentioned something about room temperature superconductors, was it?
Yeah, so we actually have superconductors. We use them all the time, for example, in an MRI machine. A superconductor is a metal which doesn't have any resistance, and the resistance in a metal is what leads to heating and power loss. So if we had a superconductor that worked, we would have basically no power losses in all of our devices, and we'd drastically reduce
Pretty much everything.
It would change the world, like, in a really drastic way. The problem is the superconductors that we do have need to be super cold. So most of them are around 4 Kelvin, which is, like, minus 260 degrees Celsius. There are some that go as high as 70 Kelvin, so about minus 200 degrees Celsius. So if you're using a superconductor in your device, you have to have a bunch of liquid cryogen, so like really cold gases or whatever, keeping your superconductor cold so that it will work.
So if I put my phone in the fridge, it's not going to be a superconductor?
No, not in your normal fridge.
Okay.
So yeah, so if we could make superconductors which worked at room temperature, the world would certainly be different.
Dr. Hoffman.
Professor Hoffman.
Sorry.
Well, either.
Now, Dr. Hoffman, she's a pretty amazing person. Apart from this, she's an ultramarathoner, and she's a parent as well.
Yeah, she's actually a mother of three, which is kind of a huge accomplishment on its own. She does have a husband, but speaking of parents, I was pretty curious about that meta study. Sam, can you explain a little bit more what a meta study is?
Sure. The word meta gets thrown around quite a bit on the internet, I think. A meta-study is where the study in question is looking back at previous research and determining how their methods and their protocols have stood up to the test of time and whether they were done accurately and precisely.
So it sounds like it's a study studying other studies?
It's a study of a study studying studies.
I see.
Hold on, Sam. Can I ask you another question? Why do we need these? I mean, are the original studies wrong, or like, what's the point of a meta-study?
It's not necessarily that they're wrong. It's just when one paper is published by a group, it's done through the eyes of those researchers. And as unbiased as they could possibly be, there are sometimes inherent biases. And when you look at a group of related research topics together and you look at the way that they're approaching similar questions or even sometimes the same questions, they'll A, approach the question with a different methodology, or B, interpret the results differently. And a meta-study is very crucial to that step of the process in how they're done and how they're interpreted.
So it's kind of like filtering out the noise in all the studies over the years, right?
Sometimes, yeah. At least like some meta-studies will do that. In this case, they were looking at trends of research in the topic of children who are reared by gay parents in contrast to children who are reared by any other type of parenting unit. That sounds weird to say, parenting unit.
I am your parental unit. Sorry, but
for example, let's one of the results that they found, and this wasn't their main conclusion, but the authors found that the majority of studies early on looking at children who are reared by gay parents, that most of the work was done on lesbian mothers rather than gay fathers, and that the sexual orientation of the children later on in life, as opposed to any other trait or characteristic, was the most studied category. So these are two examples of how studying past studies can give you an idea of what the perspective was at the time and where that general area of research is going.
Are meta-studies used in the hard sciences like physics and chemistry, or are they mostly reserved for the social sciences like economics?
I can't speak for physics and chemistry, but it is extremely common in the era of genomics, and that's the study of your genetics and your entire genome. With the amount of genetic data that's out there and accessible to the internet and to the information available, meta-studies are constantly done to see how well the past studies have done to the test of time.
I might jump in for physics here. They're not super common. I think they're in the biological sciences, they're a little bit more common, particularly in the medical sciences, and that's because often results are very hard to interpret and you need large data sets. We do have similar things across all the sciences called review article, and that's sort of one someone will provide a concise state of all the literature on a certain subject.
So it sounds like meta-studies are really useful for topics which are extremely complicated and where it's extremely difficult to really, in one study, separate all the variables and control all the variables to just discover one thing.
Yeah, and another example would be last week when we were talking about bee studies, and this one new research article showed that the best model organism for wild bees is to actually use wild bees instead of studying honeybees. So when we go back and look at all the studies that were done on honeybees, none of it is necessarily relevant compared to the wild bee studies.
Classic scientists. So back to the actual study, though, this meta-study found that there was no difference for children who were raised by heterosexual parents versus homosexual parents.
That's right, yeah. And what I find really curious is that they didn't actually talk about any specific traits. So the...
Sorry, Sam, what do you mean by traits?
Well, we may consider that when they say that they're at no disadvantage or they're no different from any other children, we want to ask, is that in terms of wealth, in terms of education, in terms of socioeconomical status later on in life, in terms of happiness, like all of these things... I think putting a blanket term like there's no differences, that seems, well, too much of a blanket. That's one...
Too big of a generalization?
Yeah.
Interesting, yeah.
Because I'd like to see what it would be like within individual categories.
Sorry, how many publications did this meta-study cover?
Initially, I thought it was 1,700, but after looking back, it almost looked like there was over 10,000 articles that they combed through.
Okay. So, like, that's a pretty good sample set, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then, sorry, how did they structure? Like, how'd they... analyze all these publications?
They did it by doing a keyword search. So they looked at the four keywords, homosexual, gay, lesbian, and same-sex, in combination with the word parent. So using those four words plus parent, they looked through all the articles that had those as keywords. And keywords are very common for research articles for researchers to be able to sift through and figure out what they want to look at. So using those keywords, they found that X number of articles, which I guess is about 10,000, were talking about same-sex parents and the outcome on children. So that's how they first refined their study, to look at those articles. And then they built a network of citations to say, oh, this person talked about this person's study, who talked about this person's study, and on and on and on, until we have this giant branching thingamajig. Like,
the word you're looking for there is graph. It's actually...
I like thingamajiggy.
Thingamajiggy's close, though. I'll tell my profs. That's interesting. A graph is actually a pretty fundamental data structure for computer scientists. It's a pretty fundamental way of how we represent things, whether it's computation, numbers. And I find it personally interesting to see this very computer science-oriented idea being seen in the social science and being done in a meta-study. Because it sounds like after they constructed this graph of citations and figure out what citated who and so forth and so on for all of time, forever.
Citated.
Citated. Cited. There we go. That they actually performed some computer science operations on this thing and came up with their own answer.
Well, that's fascinating. I'm super glad this study was done because it is important, I suppose, for the future of decisions in the courts and for culture at large, because culture does imbue some authority in science. And if they would have found the opposite, that would have been really devastating. All right. Thanks so much, Sam, Rohit, Alan, and Nathan, for your amazing contributions this week. Thanks for listening to CITR 101.9 FM's Sharing Science Radio. And stick around to hear all about space exploration next week. Up next is Sam Squanch's Hideaway.